All right, well, good morning. It's 9:07, and I'll call this meeting of the Board of Regents to order. Chief of Staff Nick Lujewski, will you please take roll?
Chair Brooks.
Here.
Vice Chair Goodman.
Here.
Regent Arriscotta.
Here.
Regent Bautista. Regent Boylan.
Aye.
Regent Brager.
Here.
Regent Brown.
Present.
Regent Carvalho.
Here.
Regent Del Carlo.
Here.
Regent Downs.
Here.
Regent Fernandez.
Present.
Regent Goicoechea.
Here.
Regent McGrath.
Here.
You have a quorum present.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll ask Regent Goicoechea to please lead us in the pledge. Okay, and with that, we'll move on to agenda item number one, which is public comment. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID 992-8475-3091 and passcode 555-555. Is there any public comment at GBC?
Good morning. No public comment at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
There's no public comment in Reno.
Thank you. Then we'll move to public comment here in Las Vegas.
Doug Unger, D-O-U-G-U-N-G-E-R. Thank you, Regents, Chancellor McNair, and Presidents for your consideration. Speaking for the Nevada Prison Education Project, we're pleased to see prison education expansion as one of NG's biennial priorities. Also, please be advised that our organization may be seeking a modest supplemental budget request from the legislature to hire Nevada for the Nevada Department of Corrections some staff members to facilitate NG's prison education programs. We would welcome a chance to discuss this proposal and coordinate with NG leadership in the near future. Speaking as a past NFA chapter president and UNLV Employee Benefits Advisory Committee member, please be alerted that we have a developing crisis with our PEB health insurance. PEB has raised premiums and out-of-pocket maximums sharply and plans to phase in more increases over 3 or 2 years, depending on the plan. If implemented, higher costs will be borne entirely by state employees. Our health plans will become unaffordable, leading to hiring and retention issues. Worse, there's unprecedented chaos with PEB accounting. Employee advocates have discovered more than $140 million in discrepancies between PEB's closing budget to the legislature in 2025 and current numbers they are reporting. State employee advocates and unions will be asking the governor and legislature for significant increases in employer contributions to correct this situation and fix this health care cost crisis. NG must plan for a health care budget impact of several millions for non-state funded positions, mainly at UNR, UNLV, and DRI, and across the system. We ask the Chancellor and Council of Presidents for an opportunity to present this dire situation at PEB in expert detail in order to discuss options and better plan for the budget impact we believe is coming. Thank you.
All right, SES, is there any public comment on the phones? Oh, I'm sorry, we have one more? We're okay. All right, any public comment through the phones, SES?
None at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move right into agenda item number two. These are our consent items. And if it's okay with the board, we'll take consent items A and B together, and I'll ask if there's a motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
Is there a second?
Second, Regent Del Carlo.
Okay, so we have a motion to approve consent items 2A and 2B made by Regent Brown and seconded by Regent Del Carlo. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye or yes.
Aye.
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 Those who oppose, please signify by saying no or nay. Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item number three. This is the 2027-29 NCHE biennial budget request process and priorities. And before we move into this agenda item, I'll ask if Regent Downs has a disclaimer he'd like to make.
Thank you, Chair. Pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A, I hereby disclose that I am an employee of the system at Western Nevada College because the independence of judgment of a reasonable person would not be materially affected by my situation. I will vote on this matter.
Thank you. We'll now move into agenda item number three, and I'll turn this over to Chief Financial Officer Brody Lesser.
Thank you, Chair Brooks, Vice Chair Goodman, Regents. For the record, my name is Brody Lesser. I am the Chief Financial Officer for the System of Higher Education, and I would like to, Chair Brooks, with your permission, just take a minute or two to introduce myself to the board. Since this is my first meeting, I did come on board April 1st, and so the last couple weeks have been a real long year trying to come up to speed. So it's my number one focus is just trying to get my arms wrapped around everything related to the budget. For those that don't know, I'm coming from the Legislative Council Bureau, where I served for just over 13 years with their fiscal division and have been involved with the system's state-supported budget accounts since the 2015 session and ever since. So I'm really excited to be here, excited to be in front of the board. I don't know if I'll say that before every meeting, but today I am for the first one. So thank you for the opportunity to present the biennial budget. We're going to talk about the process and some requests. There was some specific direction that came out of the March meeting, and that is where we're going to focus today. And that specific direction from the March meeting was that we bring back and talk about the system and institutional budget and capital project requests. Those were discussed in detail at the March meeting presented by the campus as well as the institutions. And those budgetary priorities and the capital projects, which will be our next agenda item, are all in alignment with the board system's strategic plan and the governor's priorities. So I'll do a brief recap on the NCHE budget timeline. We'll talk a little bit about the process as we've got some updated direction from the governor's finance office. As I mentioned, there was some specific direction at the March meeting to talk about some system-wide priorities. Those include fee waivers, small institution factor funding for Great Basin and WNC, deferred maintenance, and capital security. So we will focus on those today. We do have some information in the slides relating to the institutional budget priorities. I don't intend to go over those in detail, but we wanted to ensure transparency and not lose sight of those items that came before the board in March. And then finally, there was specific direction from the board that we talk about the shared funding structure of the state-supported budget and the 80% discussion. And so we'll go through that at the end of this presentation. I don't want to spend too much time on this particular slide, Chair, as this was covered in detail at the March meeting. As we continue to move through this process and we get to the board's requested priorities, we'll move on to the governor's recommended phase of the budget and then the legislative session. So we'll modify this slide as we get into those processes to add key dates. We're here in the April-May timeframe, primarily focused on the capital improvement projects that we'll go over today in a later item. And then you'll be back here May 21st to finalize the capital improvement programs. Certainly happy to talk about any additional operating budget items that you would like at that meeting. And then we go on through the schedule. There are a couple of key dates, though, that I do want to point out that we don't have on this slide. We'll add them, but there were some legislative changes that occurred in the 2025 session that we're going to keep our pulse on related to the Economic Forum. So I believe, as this body knows, the Economic Forum provides state general fund revenue projections. Those are used, and the governor is required to submit his or her recommended budget within those limitations and the revenue projections by the forum. The changes I want to make this board aware of is that previously those projections were due by December 3rd for the governor. The legislature changed that date. Those projections have been moved up to November 15th. So what does that mean for us as a system is that we're going to have an idea about, 2-3 weeks earlier than we otherwise would have, knowing what the whole picture is for the state and where the Economic Forum is projecting the general fund revenue sources. Additionally, there is some adjusted base training that I just wanted to mention that is coming up in April and May. We have coordinated with the campus staff to ensure that they are all included if they would like to attend that as we begin to actually build the mechanics of the budget. So one of the updates that we have is the governor's finance office. There's a couple of things I'll go over. First, I won't spend too much time on this. I don't want to get into the weeds on what the adjusted base budget is. But there were some changes made in 2023 that redefined how agencies would build their adjusted base budget. Those changes proved to be a challenge for agencies in the governor's office. And so there was a bill passed last legislative session, SB 462, to revert and clean up some of those changes from 23. And I'm happy to talk about details, but this will really be important as we work with the campuses to actually build that budget in the state's budgeting system. There's a policy of the governor's finance office to manage budgetary requests statewide, given limited state general fund revenue. And so there's a policy that's been adopted and has been around for numerous biennium now that the governor's finance office will work with agencies, including the system of higher education, and they calculate what is called the spending limit. Sometimes it's referred to as the two times cap. Generally, what is looked at is the appropriations from the second year of the biennium, and they double them. Now, there are certain one-offs, exceptions that they look at. And so on this slide, what we have is we're showing in the column to the far right that $1.9 million, that is the general fund limit that has been provided to the system by the governor's finance office. So what does that mean for this body? Basically, what the limit means is this is mechanically what can be put into it's generally called the agency request budget. Anything that falls outside of this limit will be entered into what is called items for special consideration. And those are enhancements beyond the limit that the governor and his staff will prioritize as they're developing the recommended budget. So it's important for us and the institutions to have this figure as we begin to build the budget. But what I want to make the board what I want to make clear for the board is that this limit does not set a cap on what we can ask for as our priorities as a system. If our budgetary priorities or enhancements fall outside of the cap, we will enter those as items for special consideration. And I just want you all to be familiar with the terminology as we get through the process and we get into the fall and we're talking about moving from the board's approved budget to the governor's recommended budget. Last thing I just want to mention on this is that this limit, there are things that are outside of the cap that historically have been approved. The main one for our campuses here would be the caseload adjustment based on an increase of weighted student credit hours. Those typically fall outside of the cap, so if they go beyond, they push us over the 1.9 million. Those are generally things that still make it into the governor's recommended budget and are not required to be considered an item for special consideration. So with that, I will go on to the priorities and again, specifically those that were requested by the board for us to address at this meeting.
Sorry to interrupt you at this point of the presentation, but there seems to be an issue with audio. And so I'm wondering if we could just take a 2-minute administrative timeout here to see if we can get audio fixed for those who are coming in on Zoom. All right, if we want to start getting back to our seats, we'll resume the special meeting this morning. Fantastic. So we'll move on to agenda item number 5. This is the Career and Technical Education Winnemucca Building at GBC. And I will ask President Amber Denali to lead this discussion off. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Brooks, Vice Chair Goodman, Regents, Chancellor McNair. For the record, I'm Amber Denali. I'm the president at Great Basin College. Today, I'm here with an information item. We have our GBC Career and Technical Education Building in Winnemucca. That building has been sponsored in part by the Tech Hub dollars that we received, a little over $2 million. We've received an additional $400,000 and then another $100,000 from GM. So it's chock full of equipment, classroom space. We have added programs like diesel and industrial maintenance. In Winnemucca, we used to just have the electrical and instrumentation program. So that building's around 10,000 square feet. Really what we need is a 20,000 square foot building, but we're happy for the 10,000 square foot that we do have. The funding that we're using to pay for that at a Tech Hub allows for a $15,000 lease per month, but that ends in 2029. So of course, we've been proactive looking to try and figure out what we're going to do for that space going forward, because the space that we're leasing right now, the owner had previously told us that he was not interested in selling. So we did do kind of a design with Public Works for a 20,000 square foot building. You saw that as part of our capital improvement request. That came in at $29 million. That's a pretty big lift for a small institution and one of our centers. So the owner of this building did come back. He owns four buildings, including three additional buildings, including the one that we're residing in right now. And he is now interested in potentially selling that building to us. And so my request today is more an information item, because if he is willing to sell that, we'd like to go ahead and get some appraisals on that. We also have an opportunity. The other three buildings are just adjacent to that building. So the fact that we need the 20,000 square feet, we might be able to do like a 10 and a 10, but we need to get those appraisals. Building space in Winnemucca is very scarce. So the fact that we potentially have an opportunity to do that is what we're asking for today. And if that goes through, I just didn't want to have a surprise visit in June and say, hey, we want to buy a building. So that's why we're presenting the information today. And I'm happy to answer any questions. We have additional programs that we will be adding in there, specifically with that GM money and the additional $400,000 that we got from WIN funding. We are adding an electrical component, an EV, and also a process plant trainer operator, and that's why we need that additional space.
Thank you, President Denali. Are there any questions from Regents? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your time and for sharing that information.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. We'll move on to agenda item number 6. This is the Procedure and Guidelines Manual Revision. 2027-29 tuition and fees, UNR School of Medicine. And I will ask President Sandoval to lead us off with this.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Regents, Chancellor, and colleagues. Good morning. For the record, my name is Brian Sandoval, President of the University of Nevada in Reno. Thank you for the opportunity to present an information item regarding proposed updates to the tuition and fee structure for the University of Nevada School of Medicine for the 2027-2029 biennium. This item is brought forward to comply with board policy in Title IV, Chapter 17, including Section 1.5 regarding the assessment of registration fees and tuition for schools of medicine. That policy requires a biennial review in the spring of every even-numbered year. Consistent with that requirement, a committee reviewed UNR Med tuition and fees, examined relevant data, and made recommendations for consideration by the chancellor and the board. In its deliberations, the committee reviewed the recommendations of a school-level tuition and fees committee, peer and regional benchmarks, including tuition and fee charges at comparable institutions in Wichita states, using AAMC data as a surrogate for direct comparison with other medical schools. The committee also considered inflation and cost pressures reflected in consumer price measures for the Western region. The Common Fund Higher Education Price Index changes in state funding over the biennium and a needs assessment of the School of Medicine. Based on that review, we are presenting proposed revisions reflecting an increase in resident and non-resident tuition and fees of 3.8% per year for each year of the 2027-2029 biennium. The proposed 3.8% increase is grounded in similar methodology used to establish changes in undergraduate and graduate registration fees under the predictable pricing program. UNR Med uses a five-year rolling average between 2021 and 2025 of the Higher Education Price Index. This approach helps the School of Medicine keep pace with inflationary pressures while remaining competitive with other public medical schools in the Western region. This proposal supports key NSHE strategic priorities, especially student access and success and workforce. The tuition increase provides critical funding to sustain and strengthen the educational experience for medical students through ongoing instructional and advising support and needed instructional materials that prepare students for required national licensure examinations. Ultimately, these investments help expand the pipeline of new physicians to serve Nevada. If approved, all tuition and fee increases, net of any increases in the university general improvement, capital improvement activities and programs, student association and technology fees, as well as the UNR Med student access fee, will be allocated to the state-supported operating budget of the School of Medicine. I also want to note, and this is important, that the student access fee is calculated as a percentage of tuition and fees, which results in automatic increase when tuition and fees increase. We recognize that any increase in tuition and fees is significant for students and can contribute to higher debt. That concern was directly discussed by the committee, and student government representatives participated, including members from the class of 2028 and the class of 2029, the two currently enrolled cohorts that would be impacted by this proposed change. The committee unanimously supported the recommended 3.8% increase in each year of the biennium. Today's presentation is for information only. At the June meeting, we will seek approval of the full amount of the proposed increase to be allocated to UNR Med's state-supported operating budget as described in your briefing materials. Final consideration on the proposed tuition and fees will be presented at the June 11-12, 2026 quarterly meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and Regents. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and it's my understanding that Dean Paul Hopman is in the audience there in Las Vegas to respond to questions as well.
Thank you, President Sandoval. Are there any regents with questions? Well, President Sandoval, I don't see any questions by regents. Thank you very much for the information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll move on to agenda item number 7. This is a handbook revision. It's production or inspection of records or files when requested for information by regents. And what I'd like to do is call on Assistant System Counsel Carrie Parker to lead off this this discussion.
And Chair Jimmy Martinez, for the record, I just wanted to introduce the item and then turn it over to Ms. Parker. This was an item that was brought forward that was worked on at the request of both the Chair and the Chancellor to address a gap in policy where We have a policy that addresses non-public records, and it loops it into a process specifically designed to protect student and employee records. And it didn't necessarily address other non-public records that Regents may want to review. So that's the purpose of this, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Parker to give you the details.
Good morning, Chair Brooks, Vice Chair Goodman, Regents, and Chancellor. Carrie Parker for the record. So as Mr. Martinez noted, this is a proposed policy revision related to Regent requests. This revision does not impact what can be requested. Instead, it impacts the submission and processing of these requests and provides an additional option for review for some of the requests. So first, I'll talk about the process, handling and tracking. Under this revision, requests would be in writing, and this helps with clarification and any follow-ups regarding what is being requested. And the request would be made to the chancellor and the chief of staff to the board, or in the case of a request to an institution, to the relevant president with a copy to the chancellor and chief of staff to the board. As far as what happens with the requests after they are made, there are two options for review of non-public information. The current policy is for non-public information, the regents come to the office to review them. This proposed revision provides another option, except for student and employee files, which always must remain at the office. Other files may be emailed to a Regents NG email if the board chair, in consultation with general counsel, instructs the general counsel to email it with appropriate safeguards and subject to the attorney-client privilege. However, highly sensitive information, which the proposed revision defines, cannot never be sent to an email outside of the NG secure network. So to sum up, whether to allow a file to be emailed and with what safeguards will be determined on a case-by-case basis by the chair with the advice of counsel, and the decision is, on a case-by-case basis, excuse me. So I stand for questions if there are any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for counsel regarding this revision? Regent Boylan. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. This has come about because of my request asking about the after-action report for the incident at Nevada State University last year. Now, I'm not sure. Thank you, Ms. Parker, though, for presenting that. I'm not sure what the second part of the change she's mentioned. What does that mean, Ms. Parker? The part that says something about, I don't even know what you said there. Could you mention the last part of your sentence, please? Or your...
Carrie Parker, for the record. I'm not sure which part you're referring to. Is it that the chair makes a decision as to whether it shall be emailed?
That, as well as something about the information, I understand that if it's personnel information of students or employees, so if a regent has made that request, then why should the chair supersede maybe, and the chair makes that request after that? I don't understand that. Well, why would the chair make the request if that's what a regent request is? It's not a chair request.
Carrie Parker, for the record. So this policy would not impact what can be requested, just the manner in which it's provided. So as we noted, the student and employee files cannot leave the office. And if there's something that is requested to be emailed, then the chair would analyze that along with general counsel to determine the level of safeguards. As we noted in the bottom footnote one, the handbook already provides reference to standards for safety and security of electronic information. There are certain laws that we must be aware of related to emailing sensitive information. So the chair would perform that analysis as to whether the item could be emailed and also whether there are appropriate safeguards that should be in place. And, of course, council would be available and any other subject matter experts to help make that decision. And if the decision by the chair was that it shouldn't be emailed, it's just too highly sensitive to be emailed, the regent would still have the opportunity to come into the office to review that material.
I see what you're saying. I think that is nonsense because the whole idea is a regent's request, not a chair's request or legal's request. I think everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people in admin or wherever it is are chipping away at the powers of the individual regents. We were elected to answer to the public, not to legal or to the chair himself. I appreciate the chair a lot, but if a regent has made a request, why does the chair need to get involved in legal? Those two things, personnel files, I totally understand. It's taken over 4 months or 5 months for this one request to be set, and eventually it was, because it was just rubbish trying to stop this request for us to analyze the AARs. So every time a regent makes a request, we're going to wait. I'm just wondering what's going to happen when I make a request for the shooting at UNLV where four were shot and three passed away. And that's a big whole other thing, the AAR for that. How's that going to work? And again, I think it's chipping away at regents' responsibilities and powers by throwing in, okay, hey, now the chair will make that request with legal. And I'll tell you frankly, I'm a wee bit tired about legal all the time. I'm not afraid of legal. Other regents and people might, legal is involved. Now we've got to be scared. I'll look into it and I'll challenge you guys also. So who brought this idea? Whose idea was this? It's not mine. And I know where all of this is coming from. But who brought this idea up that the chair and legal will decide if this individual regent has the right to this information, if it's not personal?
Just for the record, it's Chair Brooks, and I just wanted to jump in because I appreciate the questions that you're posing, and I also appreciate the amount of work, sir, that was done by System Counsel Kerry Parker, Jimmy Martinez, our Chief of Staff. And I can tell you that the way that this came about was from the initial request that you had made, because it's not something that would typically go out via email. It is typically something that a regent would come into the office to explore, much like a regent would come into the office to take a look at a personnel file. And what I was trying to do was eliminate as many barricades as possible to ensure that the regent is getting the information that they need in the fastest manner. And while working through some of this with System Counsel, what was made apparent was that System Counsel didn't want to be that final say-so in terms of whether or not something went out. They're happy to provide legal guidance and precedent and offer everything that they can for the betterment of best guidance for regents and the board as a whole, but they did not want to be the sole final decisionary maker on whether a regent received a piece of information or not electronically. And so there were, I was hoping that it could be done in a manner where perhaps it didn't fall within the chair's responsibility to support the request from the regent to be able to get something out to them electronically. But this was the best outcome I thought that could be derived of all of the outcomes that were discussed in terms of what could make good policy so that a regent gets the information that they want, and that's how this landed here. I just wanted to clarify, because I know you had questions of how or why, and I just wanted to at least provide a little bit of context.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair. But you're saying that you wanted to make sure there were less obstacles, but this is making it more obstacles, because now you get involved as well as legal. We already have, let's say, the Regent makes a request. Okay, personnel information don't get in. Everything else should be given to the regents. But thank you, and I'm sure you worked a lot with whoever you're saying you worked with, but it seems like you created a bigger obstacle for the regent that would request something. And this is not me. I don't get any personal benefit out of this. It doesn't help me. I'm saying this for all the regents. When is the next regent going to request something, and it's going to be, oh, wait a minute, first the chair and then the legal must. That's crazy. You're taking away the power from the regents to do our jobs. And this, like I'll say again, this is not my, I don't get any money out of this. I don't get any fame out of this. I'm doing the right thing to look into this matter and see why have we come to the same situation.
Chair Brooks, for the record, I appreciate everything that you're saying, Regent Boylan, and I can assure you that I'll be serving chair for about another month and a half, right? And I can tell you that I was not looking for additional materials to add to the plate of things that I do in my capacity as chair as we currently sit. And so I thought this might be the best way to suffice some of those needs and requests that you had brought up, which would be brought up again by other regents. And this just seemed to be the most efficient way of getting it done with inside legal bounds and with inside privacy. And if it's okay with you, Regent Boylan, I'll move to a couple of other regents who have comments, and then I'm happy to go back to you for further discussion.
Yeah, no, sir. I'd like to finish it right here so that okay. I can express what I'm saying and then let the others. I appreciate what you tried. I really do. And I understand your chair. But I really do believe that we have to stop putting obstacles in way of regents doing their jobs. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Regent Boylan. Regent McGrath.
I got the mic to work. I have a different concern than Regent Boylan. It's more of a technological. I just want to make sure that the language that we're adding gives the decision makers the discretion on the best technological means of transmitting something if it's transmitted electronically. I mean, my understanding, and I am definitely not an IT professional, is that attachments to emails is not considered best practices right now, even password protected. Links that expire or share files are, I think, preferred for highly sensitive information. And I just want to make sure before I decide whether to support this change that we're reflecting some discretion in the technological, the technology that could be used to actually electronically transmit, because I think that's really important.
Thank you, Regent McGrath. I'll ask System Council if they might want to weigh in on some of the IT concerns specific to sending out sensitive email.
Yeah, Jimmy Martinez, for the record, the policy does specifically say electronically transmitted. We also have another policy in the handbook that says when we're electronically transmitting sensitive data, it has to comply with certain protocols. The hard part with writing this policy was that we're writing it for the unknown. It's not like we're saying this specific document that has these things in it that we know of today can follow this process. So it had to be more of an interactive process to account for the data that may or may not be there, and to do an analysis on how best to keep that information secure. As Ms. Parker stated, the current policy allows any regent to come into the office and review any of these records. So access to the records has never been the issue. It's been whether or not the policy provides system staff the ability to send it out electronically. So that's really the crux of what this was intended for. I wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, system staff is 110% saying this is something we need. This is more of a board discussion and decision on whether or not the board as a whole would like a process like this to be able to receive these types of highly sensitive records electronically, or if the board would rather continue to come to the office and review them.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
Thank you, Council.
Now may I come back to the next?
Just one moment, Regent Boylan. With all respect, there's a couple of other regents that would like to speak. We'll go to Regent Del Carlo and then Regent Gokachia.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. I'm not in favor of changing this. I think
coming to the office is the proper way to do it under legal guidance. I don't think this sensitive stuff should be going to anybody's email. We haven't had a leak in a long time on this board, but we used to have lots and lots of leaks when I first came on this board. And that was probably before any of you that are on the board are on the board, maybe a little bit in the next 2 years after that. But I just don't see that we have a big problem here. I think what we've got is working just fine. And I'm going to be voting no on this one. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Gokachia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to go back to Council Parker. I'm just trying to clarify exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about, non-public files. So this would require a FOIA request if someone from the public wanted to access it? Or could it even be accessed that way through a FOIA, Freedom of Information?
Carrie Parker for the record. So I'll just go with the vernacular. So FOIA applies to the federal government, but I think you're talking about the Nevada Public Records Act, public records request. So this, we are talking about non-public information. So this would not be provided in response to a public records request. This is something that the regents would have privy to by being regents, not as members of the public.
Even more
sensitive. Does that answer your question?
Yes, even more sensitive than anything that could be, whether it's a Public Records Act or whatever, it would be more sensitive than that. And you're talking to probably the least techie guy in the room, but I will tell you that, if I ask for something to be emailed to me, well, it's going to come in an email. I don't know how you're going to get the sideboards on it. It's going to be on my cell phone because I can access my NISHI email address on my cell phone. I guess I'm very concerned about it. I'm not a techie kind of guy, and if I need it, I'll go to the office and get it in print. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Brown.
Thank you so much, Regent Brown, for the record. When I first read this, my first thought was, what is the ramification for a regent if information that is shared via electronic communication is distributed beyond the Board of 13 and our staff? I know in the private sector things are different, right? You can fire someone, you can take stock options, you can sue them. Technically, people can be sued here, but and I appreciate Regent McGrath bringing up the password protected and links that expire. Those are forms that I'm familiar with and comfortable with, but this to me feels like a solution looking for a problem. We have access to all the documents. Regent Gokachia is the only one that doesn't live within the 50-mile radius, and he even just said that he'll come into the office if there's something he needs to look at. And so for me, I feel like this is not something that I think is important for us to expand the reach and the scope, and it opens ourselves up to a lot of potential liabilities and problems. So with my colleague, Regent Del Carlo, I will also not be supporting this. Thank you.
Are there any other regents? With Regent Borland, I said that I would go back to you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. I appreciate the views of all the regents there. But some of us regents have more time on our hands than others. Some of us have to work for a living, I guess, and I have to do things that I cannot come into the office for. It's very nice for the staff and for legal. They're sitting there in the offices and getting paid for that time. So, yeah, I appreciate all these concerns. I see it as, how would I say this? I see this as admin and legal whittling away at our, I wouldn't say power is a big word, but our ability to do our jobs without going out too much and saying, oh my gosh, now I have to take so much time out of my work, get to the office, go and take a look at it. It's not personnel information. And yes, if you did a request like the council just said, it's not a FOIA request, but this would come up and you would get it. I've got my information about the shooting at UNLV without even requesting it. It's on the internet, for heaven's sake. And this is an even smaller incident. So this just seems to me, hey, it's not my concern. I didn't bring this up. So if there's just one region concerned about it, who gives a fudge? Okay, go for it. But I just don't understand you guys. Thanks, Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Regent Borland. And I do at least want to suggest that there is several sections to this revision. And perhaps if regents are not amenable to the changes that are in Section 5, which has to do with the electronic sending of non-personnel documents, that perhaps Section 4 maybe there's some validity in the restructuring of Section 4. And so I'd like to open up further discussion if there's an appetite to take part of this revision and not the full revision. Again, in Section 4, it does talk about how when regents are making requests, that information will come through essentially the Chief of Staff's office for distribution to all regents.
And Chair, Jimmy Martinez, for the record, just while everybody is reviewing that, I'll just put on the record that I think that's reasonable. Legal specifically worked on Section 5. Section 4 were more administrative changes that we were asked to incorporate since we were already working on this item.
Regent Del Carla. I'm sorry, Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the suggestion that you made. So it looks to me, and perhaps our legal team can tell me if I'm wrong, that based on what was just said, we could approve these changes with the exception of Section 2B, if we agree that perhaps the allowability of electronic communications would not be included in this.
Yeah, Jimmy Martinez, for the record, I think what you would want to do
2B
is
at 5.
It would just be the changes in the record on Title 4, Chapter 1, Section 4, and it would not be any of the changes in Section 5, which relates to inspection of files.
Okay. Well, my only question then, in Section 5, number 2, that second sentence, prior to inspection of any other non-public files, including non-public records, a regent must provide a written request to the chancellor and chief of staff to the board. We would probably want to include that, correct?
Jim Martinez, for the record, I think you could include that. I don't know if it's necessary. I would also, if the chief of staff would like to chime in and let us know if she sees that would go along with the changes in Section 4, if it was unnecessary in that respect.
Thank you, Chair. Carrie Nikolajewski, chief of staff to the board. Certainly that could be approved without that addition there, but it's just helpful for tracking and making sure that regent requests are not in the wind.
I agree.
Okay. Then I would like to make a motion. To approve the changes to Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 4, all of the changes, and Section 5, just that change to Subsection 2. And subsection A. So that would not include the section that was B, subsection B in 5.
Okay, Regent Carvalho, just to recap, your motion is to approve the proposed changes to Title IV, Chapter 1, Section 4 in its entirety. And then, and also include the proposed changes in Section 5, but just limit that to 2A. Is that correct?
That is correct. That would be my motion.
2 and 2A, right? I don't know if that matters.
Yes, 2 and 2A, not 2B.
Thank you, Regent Carvalho. So we have a motion to approve Section 4 and Section 5, except for omitting, we'd be omitting 2B in Section 5. Is there a second to this motion?
Motion to second.
Thank you. So we have a motion by Regent Carvalho to approve. We have a second by Regent Brown, and I'll move for board discussion and call on Regent Brager.
Thank you very much. It's gone a little further from when I was going to make my comment, but I really do believe that the email would be extremely dangerous. There's not firewalls we can put up that could save us there. And so I think we're moving in the right direction for the protection, and driving in for something which is probably very rare is what we should be doing, so that everything is very protected. That's just all that I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Brager. So is there any other discussion? Then we'll move directly into a vote, and I'll ask Chief of Staff Nick Wojcicki to help us out with a roll call vote.
Regent Arriscotta?
Yes.
Regent Batista is absent. Regent Boylan?
No.
Regent Brager?
Yes.
Chair Brooks?
Yes.
Regent Brown?
Yes.
Regent Carvalho?
Yes.
Regent Del Carlo?
No.
Regent Downs?
Oh. No.
Regent Fernandez? Absent. Regent Goycochea?
I don't know.
Yes.
Vice Chair Goodman?
Yes.
Regent McGrath?
Yes.
The motion passes.
Thank you. And with that, we'll move. We'll move to the next agenda item, which is agenda item number 8, new business. Are there any regents who would like to bring a new business item forward? I don't see any.
Chair, I would like to.
Regent Downs.
Thank you. I mean, I'd like to reiterate that I'd like to have a whole agenda item to discuss collective bargaining, that we could have a full presentation, so people understand what collective bargaining is. I don't want to say pros and cons, but I also want to throw in there a discussion about arbitration. I keep hearing from people who say they're in negotiations and they're told by the other side that the board won't approve arbitration. And I've been on the board for 3 years. I've not been asked once as a board member how I feel about arbitration. So I don't know if that's a fair thing to be representing our perspective. Maybe the majority doesn't support arbitration, but it'd be nice to have that discussion and have it stated. So I would like to have that come forward. And also maybe some education about what good faith bargaining is. I asked for this before, can ask for it again. It'd be nice if some more regions jumped on it so we could make this onto an agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Downs. Is there any other new business? Seeing none, we'll move into agenda item number 9, which is public comment. Is there any public comment at GBC?
No public comment this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment at the system office in Reno?
None at this time.
Thank you. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas?
My name is Pio Rejas, P-I-O space R-E-J-A-S. I currently serve as the Season Attorney General. This is on behalf of my president, Kelechi Odunze. We appreciate that you've been concerned about student voices and that we're part of the conversation, specifically in the priorities for the legislative sessions. We would appreciate if we were still part of the conversation when we go to the 84th legislative session. Thank you very much for these proposals today. I yield the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. SCS, is there any public comment on the phone?
No colors at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you. All right. So it looks like SCS was able to save the morning and get everything back online. So we'll resume our meeting and we'll turn it back over to you. Thank you.
I request that he goes back to where we lost sound.
That's a great idea. Maybe we'll go back a slide. I'm not sure where we would have lost the exact point in your presentation, but
with the budget. Yes, this one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Chair Brooks. For the record, again, Brody Leiser. I believe there's a request to go back, pick up with this slide. I'll recap the comments that I made, and we'll try and do a better job here getting my mouth close to the microphone so everyone can hear. What I was saying earlier is that the governor's finance office has established a policy that has been around for several biennia, and the policy essentially is to manage the budgetary requests that come through executive branch agencies given limited state general fund revenue. And the limit that is provided generally is calculated as taking the second year appropriation and multiplying it by 2. However, there are individual considerations beyond that. And so the calculation itself is something that is provided by the governor's finance office staff. And if you look at the very right side of the table here, that $1.9 billion, that is the cap that was calculated by the governor's finance office for the system and provided to us. Now, what that means is that limits what can be entered into what is generally referred to as the agency request budget. Any general fund requests that would fall outside the cap are classified and entered, requested as items for special consideration. And those items are then reviewed by the governor's finance office and their staff to determine what is going to be included within his or her recommended budget that is presented to the legislature. So the point that I wanted to make with the slide for those that did not hear earlier is that the limit and the cap does not limit what can be requested. It just rather determines how it's classified. And so the Board of Regents, through setting its priorities, does not have to stay within the cap, but just understand anything outside of the cap will generally be classified as an item for special consideration. And we just want to make sure everyone's familiar with the lingo as we move beyond June and August, when the board prioritizes its operating budgets and we move into the GovRec phase. I also noted earlier that historically, the caseload adjustment in particular for our instructional institutions has been outside of the cap. So we have not been limited as a system to ensure that those caseload adjustments are included within the agency request budget. And that's important. These numbers and the cap are extremely important for us at the system office, but also at the institutional level as we really get into the details of building the budget. So next, I was beginning to talk about the operating priorities, and this is, again, we'll have a focused discussion based on direction from the March board meeting, but just, again, this is a slide that was presented at March, but we have ensured that in addition to, you know, addressing the board's strategic plans, that the budgetary enhancements are in alignment with the governor's three-year plan priorities. One of the first, one of the items that was specifically discussed and requested that we bring back for presentation today had to do with the system-wide request for fee waivers. So this was discussed in detail in March, and the systematic request, budgetary request here is focused on the two fee waivers that you see here on the slide, the Native American fee waiver and the National Guard fee waiver. While these are not the only fee waivers in the program, these are statutorily mandated. And they're mandated for the students that are eligible, which means the institutions are not collecting the registration fees that otherwise would have been collected. And so there is, and I'm probably going to get the numbers wrong, which is something you never want to hear from your CFO, but I believe that there was about $440,000, and someone can correct me if I'm wrong, somewhere in that neighborhood has been appropriated to cover fee waivers for the system as a whole. That $440,000 is nowhere near sufficient to offset the loss of registration fees. So how did we get to a request of almost $23 million for the upcoming biennium? In fiscal year 2025 or academic year 2024-25, across all institutions, about $8.2 million in registration fees were waived. These fees were waived for just over 1,800 students, which is amazing. The policy is working. The students are there, and we're seeing growth in students taking advantage of the policy. I'm not here to talk about the policy today, but to talk about the numbers and where they're coming from. The Native American fee waiver, there was just over 700 students. $3.9 million was waived in 25. For National Guard, it was 3.5 and just over 790 students. So how do we get to a request of $22.8 million over the biennium? Well, in fiscal year 2024, the amount waived was $6.1 million. So it jumped from $6.1 million to $8.2 in 1 year. We are anticipating a 20% growth in the fees waived in 26. We're working on finalizing those numbers, and when we have them, we will bring them to the board. But we're anticipating about a 20% annual growth with these fee waivers. So that is where the numbers come from. And again, the reason that we're focused on these is that these are the largest financial impacts to our institutions. And there's a statutory mandate by the legislature that these registration fees are waived.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. Are there any, and I know this is a policy thing, we can talk about it offline, but I just want to put it on record. For our fee waivers for both of these groups, are they required to be in state for X amount of time before they can apply for the waiver? If you know that off your head, great. If not, I'm happy to discuss it offline.
I have a general understanding, Vice Chair Goodman. I don't want to put something incorrect on the waiver. I believe that the residency requirements for the Native American fee waiver get a little bit tricky, and I don't want to put something incorrect on the record. If you're okay, I would be happy to follow up and
Great.
Provide information on the residency requirements.
Perfect.
But there are some complexities, in particular with the Native American fee waiver and the recognition of not only the tribal entities within the state, but the states that border Nevada and, as I understand it, potentially tribal communities across the country.
Yes.
Once they reside and move to Nevada. But in terms of the length of time that they need to be here to be considered a resident or fall under the fee waiver, I will get you those details so I get you a complete picture.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to move on from the fee waivers. We're going to talk a little bit about the small institution factor funding. And I forgot to mention, but I know that in March, you will see this reoccurring theme that we have here on the heading of the slide, addressing the adequacy of funding for the system and our institutions. And so this is a great example where we're talking about the small institution factor. I do want to just talk very briefly about a couple policy changes that occurred last session. I know these were covered in March, but the small institution factor, what changed last session was that the legislature increased the threshold for which the calculation is based on. That's the cap of the weighted student credit hours was raised to 125,000. And there was also an increase to the rate, the weighted student credit hour rate that's applied to this calculation, as it had not been changed since the implementation of the most current version of the formula. And that change was to apply the HEPI rate to the weighted student credit hour value back to its inception. And so going forward, what the request is, the legislature last session, due to limited ongoing operating revenues to support expenditures, this was funded, the changes themselves were funded at 20 and 40%. And so what the requests that we're bringing forward, the GBC and WNC with support of the system office, is that we fund that at 100% per year. And so we do have some numbers on here that I won't go through in detail. We need to refine these numbers quite a bit. And as we come back to May and June, I will have updated numbers on what we're looking at in terms of funding this at 100%. I can tell you that in FY27, I believe GBC received about $1.2 million for this funding, and WNC received about $386,000. And so funding it at 100% will also be dependent on where those institutions are with their growth and weighted student credit hours. So we will bring revised numbers back as we continue through the process. But this was, again, one of those areas that specifically was requested.
Thank you, Regent Brown, for the record. And I just want to say I am happy to see this as one of our top priorities that were listed, because, you know, I think our state is so unique. Yes, 74% of the population lives in Clark County, but we have, you know, 16 other counties, 15 other counties that our two institutions cover. And that requires, you know, it costs more money to do that. I've talked to these presidents. We might have a classroom with 30 students at one of our, urban community colleges, but they might have a classroom with 6 students. And it's important, if Nevada is saying that we want to educate everyone in the state, rural, urban, regardless, it is important that we put the money and resources in here. And I know that cuts had to be made towards the end of the legislative session. That always happens. But I really do hope that as a system, we say that this is one of the things that we just can't bend on, because it is important for these two institutions. You know, what they are providing in these, you know, smaller communities matters, and it matters for the people that live there, and it matters for our state. So I'm glad to see it was one of the first things that we listed here. So I just wanted to say that for the record.
Chair Brooks, I'd like to chime into that too, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Regent DiCarlo.
Right, it's difficult on Zoom, but yes, thank you, Regent Brown, for saying that. And I want to remind everybody, this is April is Community College Month, and I couldn't agree more. This small institution factor, Brody, is very, very important to our smallest institutions. And community colleges really do the heavy lift for workforce development, and that's what our state truly needs, no matter where you are, but especially in our rural counties. So we really need this funded properly, and it was disappointing at the last session. I certainly didn't want to harm the universities, but this really did harm our small institutions over the last 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regent Goykechea, for the record, and I can only echo, you know, that how important it is to these small institutions. And then I'll turn to Mr. Leiser, coming from LCB. You know, let's be honest. What we're talking about here, $1 million, $1.5 million, it's budget dust. And so, you know, it's attainable, I think. And for what $1.5 million does for these institutions, you just can't. It's $150 million at UNLV. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I will make one brief comment in response to the comments by the regents, and I thank you. We understand and certainly know for Western Nevada and Great Basin how important this funding is. Nothing is guaranteed, but I think that a recognition to the budget closing and the legislative actions last session of beginning the phase in, there is an expectation that we are going to come and ask for 100% of this funding. So thank you for the additional discussion on this. And again, we will continue to revise the numbers and what they look like as we move forward. There was a specific request to talk about deferred maintenance. We have it here, but we're going to talk about this more in detail in the CIP presentation, so I won't go into too much detail here. Additionally, there was specific direction to talk about the public safety requests that were submitted. As you recall from the March meeting, each of the institutions had specific security requests, and as a system, the figures on the slide here represent a biennium request, and we will continue to work with the campuses and their chief business officers, their business officer group, to understand the details on these requests. But this funding would go to support things such as staffing, security camera upgrades, including integrated surveillance, classroom safety, including panic software, the ability to lock down if necessary, action plans, preparedness efforts, badging systems, door locks, access systems, emergency power lighting, bollards. Across the board, I think the campuses have demonstrated a need and desire to invest in public safety, and that's clearly was something that the board wanted to focus in on, and so we've included that here today. I also just would reiterate, as discussed during the March meeting, that all of the institutions have been able to either expend or commit the $11 million that was appropriated last session through AB 567. So this is new money. This is in addition to that. And so we will continue to bring more details on this as we move forward in the process. As I mentioned, Chair Brooks, the following slides do include some other priorities that were presented during the March meeting. There was a narrow focus direction coming out of the March board meeting to talk about the things that we just covered. So I don't intend to go into detail on these, but again, want to have them listed for transparency purposes. There's a couple that I do want to note that are not on here, but that we know are a priority for our universities and our colleges. One is the knowledge account, and so that is an extremely important request for our universities, and so we have not lost sight of that. as well as a request for funding for the Workforce Innovations for a New Nevada account, in addition to a separate workforce proposal from Truckee Meadows Community College. So those are things that we know are also priorities of the institutions and the board, and if they're not on here, please don't think it was intentional, and I welcome all the institutions to let me know if I've left something off the slide. I know you're not shy. The last item in this agenda item, there was a specific request, and thank you, Vice Chair Goodman, for asking to have this be brought back and discussed here today, regarding the 80% discussion. And really, I have tied this into a shared funding structure discussion because I believe that that's important. And so I'm going to take an opportunity to go through a little bit of the background. I'm not going to give a detailed history on this. If you want one, I will do it. And I have some material. In my previous role, did a presentation, I believe it was February 14th, 2025, before the Joint Money Committees, and I would guess a lot of you saw that presentation. But my point is, if you want more detail, I've got it. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have today. But generally, I wanted to take an opportunity to talk about a couple things. First is that in order for us to understand what happened in 2019 and the changes that have occurred since then, it's really important for us to look at a policy that came out of a recommendation from the 2011-2012 Interim Committee to Study the Funding of Higher Education. That is the committee that established the most recent version of the funding formula. There were certain policy considerations that came out of that body that were recommended by the governor and ultimately adopted by the legislature. The main one relating to this discussion has to do with student fee, tuition, and general fund offset policy. It was important at that time, and I believe is still important today, for our institutions that we have this policy in place, as it allows for an exemption of Section 7. And what the policy did is really decoupled the general fund and the student registration fees and the non-resident tuition. Prior to this policy change, the institutions of higher education, like other state agencies, were subject to what's called Section 7 of the Authorizations Act. Section 7 of the Authorizations Act is a policy that to limit the use of general fund for expenditures that otherwise are eligible to be funded with non-general fund revenue sources that are received beyond their budgeted amount. So what the heck does that mean? So if we have a budget that is $1 million, and it's funded $500,000 in general fund and $500,000 in fee revenue, and that's the budget, under Section 7, if an agency were to bring in $600,000 of revenue, they would be required to set aside $100,000 of general fund and revert that to the general fund. So under that policy prior to 2013, there was a perception that in the event that the institution collected registration fees beyond what was in the legislatively approved budget, those institutions were subject to Section 7. That meant that any registration fees collected beyond the budgeted amount, with certain exceptions, the institutions were required to set aside an equal amount of general fund and send it back to the state. That created a perception that the institutions were not keeping student registration fees on their campus. That is where this policy came from. Generally, there were some other discussions going on, but that's important as we get into the discussion with the current funding structure and in particular what happened with the COLA in 2019. So when the general fund and the student registration fees were decoupled, There was an exemption from Section 7. So today, if an institution brings in more registration fee revenue, non-resident tuition, than what's in the state-supported budget, the institution is not required to revert an equal amount of general fund. The institution is allowed to expend those fees without having to go through IFC approval process as long as we report on how those additional fees are used. So that has been the benefit of, you know, the Section 7 exemption, I know is something that is very important to our institutions and to the system as a whole. So when that happened and when the funding was completely decoupled, we now have a shared funding structure, and what it means is our institutions collect registration fees from various departments throughout their institutions, and we've got state-supported budget, state-supported general fund operating and personnel expenditures. It is extremely difficult to try and specifically map out what expenditures are associated with registration fees, say from, you know, the history department. So generally, we do not align our revenues with specific expenditures, and therefore the assumption and understanding is that everything within the state-supported budget is proportionately shared based on the revenue sources within that budget. So the other piece of that, the non-offset that I will mention before I get to the COLA, is I talked about how it goes one way, right? Like if an institution collects more revenue, registration fee revenue than they were budgeted, exempt from Section 7, not required to revert general fund. If an institution collects less revenue than what they budgeted for registration fees or non-resident tuition, the general fund's not going to come in and help. Like that's, you know, it works both ways. And that's where the policy, comes from. It comes from that interim study during the 2011-2012 study. And so the current NCHE-specific COLA funding policy, I won't go into details, but as everyone in this room knows, it changed in the 2019 legislative session. I'll talk very briefly about what it was before that in context of why. As you all know, that time-wise, COLA funding that's considered by the legislature typically does not get approved until the final days of the legislative session. And we're talking probably, you know, day 110 or after. By that time, the institution's budgets have closed. The money committees have made their decisions on the operating budgets, including registration fee levels at that time. And as the budgets were closed, the policy of the legislature was that given the timing of the budget closures, COLA decisions, and the fact that our institutions have students enrolled in the fall, there's a real serious timing issue, and so COLA funding was provided at 80%. That changed, as you all are aware, in the 2019 session. How it came about, if you want a detailed history, I'll give you one. I think there's been a lot of discussion, and I'm not here to you know, hide anything. As everyone knows, when the budget was proposed in 2019, the COLA that was proposed in the governor's recommended budget was based off an 80% by 80% calculation. That resulted in 64%, right? That was known during the 2019 legislative session. There was no action taken by the governor's office to submit a budget amendment to change that funding. Unfortunately, there was no discussion in a public hearing, in a budget hearing, in a hearing about the COLA as to the funding level with regards to the higher education institutions. And that is something that I talked about in the meeting I referenced last legislative session. Everyone benefits when policy discussions occur in open meetings. Everyone benefits when it's clear what is being considered and why it's being considered. And I think that there is a recognition that in 2019 that did not happen. However, what was approved by the 2019 legislature was intentional. And I can tell you that as from my former role, but I can't sit up here and point you to meeting minutes or to a meeting hearing where this occurred. There were discussions around the proportionate share of funding for our institutions, and that while initially the calculation was 80% of 80%, it mathematically did align with the proportionate funding split. And when you tie it back to that offset policy that I talked to earlier, that is that's the policy, and that's where it comes from. Now, I have something else on here, and I want to go back to the 80%, but there are some other things that I've noted, and that is that there are other policies that have changed. Prior to the 2005 legislative session, COLA funds for the board of for the higher education institution, that money was appropriated to the system. It was not appropriated to the Board of Examiners. There were some concerns at the time about whether or not the funding that was appropriated for COLA was actually being used for COLA. And so in the 2005 legislative session, that policy changed. So as you all are aware, COLA money that gets approved or has been approved, now all of it goes to the Board of Examiners. And we as a system are required to go justify and seek approval for the Board of Examiners. So I note that for a couple reasons. One is, I think there are some things that we can consider as a body moving forward of how we want to address this, and ultimately it's up to the board, you know, on the direction to go. But, you know, what is that right funding split? You know, what is the appropriate funding split for our institutions? You know, and there's work being done, and I know that Applied Analysis came and presented to this board in September to look at peer institutions and best practices. So I think this is right in alignment with that discussion, and where does the board want to go down the road? The last thing I'll say on this is that I also think that we need the collective, we as a system, as a state, the governor's office, the legislature, like in the event that another 12% and 13% COLA get approved, 12 and 11, that's a substantial impact. And so I think that there is a reasonable argument to looking at that, particularly that first year of the biennium, when decisions are not being made on this until late May, early June, and we've got institutions that have students committed to enrollments in the fall, that maybe we look at the first year of the biennium a little bit different, or if it's the policy of the board, we look at the entire thing. But wanted to at least share those thoughts, and I apologize because I know I can tend to babble a little bit, but I know this is an important discussion. I am willing to answer any questions that you have on this. Again, if you're interested, there was a detailed presentation that I'm happy to forward on the PowerPoint. But I know this was an important discussion topic, and so I wanted to cover it. And with that, regarding that matter or any other thing, if you have questions, I think we still have a tone in the room. We can get him up here to answer questions, Mr. Batone. No, I would be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Perfect. Thank you. Board. Thank you, CFO Leiser. Are there any Please. Questions from the board? Regent Gokachia?
Thank you, and I'm sitting here with a hot mic, and I hope it wasn't going through because I was mumbling to myself. I almost feel like I need to make a disclosure. You know, you're going a long ways back, Brody, and unfortunately, you know, in the 11th session, I was a minority leader that brought some. You have to understand, we were coming out of the 9-10 recession, and we were really scrambling for money, and that can happen again for the next legislature. But my real question is, technically, as we lobby and going forward, into the next legislative session, and understanding that, you know, the state funds that are appropriate to go through the BOE, the Board of Examiners, I feel there's real opportunity to fix where we ended up with the 12, the 9 and the 12 as far as the fee increase we put going forward. Again, we're only at 2 and 3. So I really feel that, you know, going back and justifying what we did 6 months ago, you know, with the fee increase, really we had to do something to go to the legislature with it, to go to the governor with it, to go to the Board of Examiners with it and say, hey, we put this in place. But we never intended to end up at 12%, the 9 and the 12. And so help us. And, you know, again, the Board of Examiners is very powerful, and I think they'll hear our case. Any comments to that, Brody? Mr. Leiser, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Regent Goycochea. I think my comment response to your comments are that I think that the action that this board took in January will go a long way in bringing the budget request to the governor and to the legislative body next session to show that the board has made a commitment to bring it to address some of our challenges and shortfalls that we have. And to your point, Regent Goycochea, the increases that were approved 3-4 years out can be reviewed down the road if the institutions and the system were in a different position. But I believe that the action taken by the board will go a long way when we get to the next steps of the budgetary cycle and we approach the governor's office and we continue to engage with the governor's office about the board's priorities and what the board is committed to and the institutions have committed to and the students have committed to for the upcoming biennium. I think that's a very important message.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Regent Del Carlo. We can't hear you here.
Sorry, I was trying to unmute. I'm trying to unmute. Thank you. First of all, I just want to welcome you, Brody. I'm just thrilled you're here from the legislature and have such a deep knowledge and history going back, because you're talking about some stuff I'm hearing for the first time, and I've been on the board 10 years, but I don't understand the Board of Examiners part. I don't even know what the Board of Examiners honestly does. So can you just give us a little detail there? And, you know, I'm so appreciative of Regent Goycochea for all his background, too. And maybe I can come into your office, Brody, in the future and have some more discussion. But, I mean, there's just things you're talking about that I don't even know what you're talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo. Sometimes I feel like I'm talking about what I don't know what I'm talking about. So, but to generally answer your question, the Board of Examiners consists of the governor, the attorney general, and the secretary of state. Among other things, they're tasked with contract approvals, agreement approvals, various financial related transactions as they relate to the executive branch of the government. So what has historically happened with regards to COLA funding is that the legislature appropriates the COLA funding to the Board of Examiners. And the reason that that is done is that agencies may or may not need that additional funding to meet the impacts of the COLA. If an agency has vacancy savings or savings in another area of their budget, they may not need to go to the Board of Examiners to access those funds. It's a mechanism to make sure that there's funding available, but also sets it aside understanding that there may be other budgetary savings that agencies could achieve to address the impacts of the COLA. And so there is a process where we as a system, if there is funding that's been appropriated to the Board of Examiners, are required to substantiate a request for allocation through the governor's finance office, and then we go to the, before the board to get that approval. And I'd be happy to meet with you to talk about more details, but I hope that provides some context.
Could I?
Vice Chair Goodman.
Thank you.
Thank you so much and welcome. We're thrilled that you're here and congratulations on your position as CFO for the system. I also want to say that, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so this is just, I kind of feel like we have a secret weapon here in that we are able to really navigate things much better. And so I appreciate this presentation and I appreciate your knowledge. And I also appreciate the information on the 80%. Thank you.
President Heavey.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Brooks, and for that presentation, Brody. Two pieces of context that I think Brody would confirm that are important in how the universities operate. One is that justification for the COLA happens extremely late in the fiscal year, which means you've basically expended the money before you know how much of the money you're going to get reimbursed back from the state, which makes it very difficult from the budgeting perspective. And the other thing, obviously, is the difference from other state agencies in the tremendous variation in enrollment that one can have. And so the whole issue of the separation of being able to keep the fees is a very important evolution in the way we handle the funding, because those fees obviously mean you're serving a lot more students when you exceed the budgeted amount. And so other state agencies don't really have to deal with it, because DMV doesn't generally have a dramatic variation in how many people they serve. And so I think those two factors are very complicated issues for the campuses to manage. And does that all jive with your understanding, Brody?
Yeah, President Heavey, I would agree with that, yeah.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from Regents? Well, CFO Leiser, thank you very much for that presentation. This is an item for possible action. And before we move into the vote, I just want to again say welcome aboard, and we appreciate you being here and the amount of knowledge that you bring. Is there a motion to approve the budget request process and priorities?
Motion to approve, Regent McGrath.
Second.
Thank you. So we have a motion from Regent McGrath to approve the budget request process and priorities, seconded by Regent Brown. Is there any discussion?
Chair Brooks, let me just jump in here for a moment, if you don't mind.
I think you did. Counsel, go ahead.
Yeah. I would defer to Mr. Leiser, but I don't know if a motion is needed at this time, because this is going to be brought back. Is that correct, Brody?
Thank you. For the record, Brody Leiser, I don't believe there needs to be an official action taken by the board today. And I apologize, Chair Brooks. I should have provided a little more context when I began. I will not use the excuse that I'm 2 weeks in trying to learn everything, but it was my birthday yesterday, and I'm not above using that. So, this I think what we could, if you have a desire to provide direction on what you would like us to bring back, or if you would like any additional detail at the May 21st meeting, or if you have any direction or the board has any direction on what you would like to see specific to the operating budgets as we prepare to go into the June quarterly meeting, where we will have a more robust discussion on the operating.
Well, thank you, Council and CFO Leiser. I think those are great considerations that you're providing for us. And if there's, I think that would then come here as information only, not possible action, and also open it up for additional discussion in terms of direction. Regent Gokachia?
Yeah.
With the motion in place in a second, if we can just tie to it, just keep it coming, Mr. Leiser.
Mm-hmm. So, Regent
Chair, I will withdraw my motion, Regent McGrath.
And I will withdraw my second.
Great. And so this will again be viewed as an information-only item. Again, we appreciate that. And we'll move into
Chair Brooks.
Regent Borland.
Thank you, Chair. I make a motion that we sing happy birthday to him. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Regent Borland. Unfortunately, council just texted me to say that that's not on the agenda. And so we won't be able to do that. But I appreciate the nicety to, right. to support the birthday.
Thank you, council.
Yeah, and with that, we'll move to agenda item number four, visible capital construction planning and deferred maintenance. And there's two things I'd like to do before we move into that agenda. The first would be to provide Regent Downs an opportunity for disclosure.
Thank you, Chair. Assuming this is an action item, like the last one, assuming we're going to have action pursuant to NRS Chapter 281A, hereby disclose that I am an employee of the system. And because the independence of judgment of a reasonable person would not be materially affected by my situation, I will vote on this matter if there is one. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Downs. And you're right. It is listed as an action item. But again, we can move this to information only if that would benefit the board better than casting a vote on the deferred maintenance requests.
Yeah, Chair Brooks, I mean, it is noted as possible action on the agenda, which just gives you the board the ability to take action, but you do not have to take action. So,
fantastic. So then we'll move this as information only. And again, I believe CFO Leiser is kicking this off. Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. Vice Chair Goodman, Matt McNair, Entry Chancellor for the record. Just a couple of items before we invite CFO Leiser up. First, since you don't all do this all day every day, I think you've gotten a sense of CFO Leiser, but I can't tell you the number of comments and calls I've gotten since he started about how lucky we are to have him, and I think you saw that today. We got a little bit of a history lesson, and we're going to have, I think, a different relationship with the legislature going forward because of that. So we're really grateful that he's on the team, and as we add team members, we're concerned not just with their subject matter expertise and their relationships, but also their leadership and their competence. So we're really lucky to have CFO Leiser on the team. Didn't skip a beat from another great CFO, Chris Fatone, so we're lucky for that. Also wanted to say, as we go into this next item, I just wanted to extend my thanks to Chris Fatone and Brody, CFO Leiser, and the business officers for how we came up with this list. I think it's a great example of systemness. We actually had the business officers create a formula and a process for putting this list together to develop the priorities that all of the business officers and all of the presidents are endorsing, and it's not final yet, but as we go forward, even if the campus's priorities weren't at the top of the list, they all agreed on the list. So I just wanted to thank them for their partnership. And now we will invite CFO Leiser up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chancellor. Again, Chair Brooks, for the record, Brody Leiser, Chief Financial Officer for the system. Before I begin, I do want to note we did post some supplemental information. We updated slides 10 through 12 that was posted on the website earlier this week. And I just want to apologize for having to make those corrections. But I really do appreciate the campus staff and the business officer groups working so quickly with me to make sure that what we're presenting here today is accurate information as well as consistent with the information presented by the campuses. So we're going to cover the capital improvement process, the criteria to evaluate projects, as well as the recommended lists of projects. So this slide, I won't go through this in too much detail. You know, where we're at today is we've got this meeting on April 17th where the board will have an opportunity to engage in discussion regarding the ranking list of the projects that has come through the process. And we will meet again on May 21st for this board to finalize that ranking. And so, again, if there is any input that comes out of today's discussion that you would like us to address come the May meeting, we would be happy to do that. But just want to give you sort of the key dates on that. So we'll be back next month to finalize this list. We do that in May so that we can get the final ranking of the board into Public Works. And then late in August, the Public Works Board will have hearings to hear about the projects from the agencies. I would just note that we are working with Public Works staff to ensure that we don't have a conflict there on the 27th, as I believe there's a board meeting. So the Title IV of the Regents Handbook, Chapter 10, Section 26, was updated following the 2022 prioritization cycle. And this just outlines, as the Chancellor went over, business officers review and initially rank those projects. The Council of Presidents review that list. And here we are today where the Chancellor has forwarded a prioritized list of those projects based on the discussions that have been had. So getting into a little bit more detail, and I'll talk a little bit on the next couple slides on the actual ranking criteria, but the business officers discussed and agreed ranking criteria, went through, ranked those projects as a group. I do want to note, and again, my appreciation to everyone for being so welcoming and on my very first day, I got to participate in a call with the chief business officers to specifically talk about the CIP project. So thank you to the institutions for including me right away to help get prepared for this meeting. As I mentioned, we do have a couple slides here to just talk about the criteria that's used to evaluate projects. You know, I don't want to read these to you, but I'll leave the slides up here for a second so that you can see the various criteria that was used by the business officers. In addition to the criteria that we have outlined here, it was an important component for the group to ensure that there's inclusion of both a planning and construction project. So when I get to the list, you'll see towards the top that we do have a construction project for the College of Southern Nevada. There's a planning project for Nevada State. Those both were also considerations in developing this list. And one other thing that we don't have listed on here, but I know from prior communications was important to the board that we look at the board's prior rankings of these projects. As you all know, there are projects that show up on these lists every biennium because of funding challenges through the legislature due to limited resources. So that brings us to the rank list. There, I want to talk a little bit make a few points, but the institutions, as you all know, the institutions presented individual projects as well as some deferred maintenance needs at the March meeting, so I don't intend to go through the projects in detail. I will note, and thank you to board staff for having the revised, the corrected slides here for the presentation today. I mentioned that earlier. You'll see projects starting with CSN. There's an asterisk there. That was updated with the supplemental information. None of the updates were modifying scopes of the projects. It was just clarifying the funding split. In this instance, we wanted to ensure that we were reflecting that $10.5 million commitment coming from both the foundation as well as the institution itself. There was, as I mentioned in the previous presentation, one of the specific charges coming out of the March meeting was to talk about deferred maintenance. I'm going to talk more about HECSHEC. That was a specific request. I've got a slide to talk a little bit more history at the end of this presentation. But, you know, I think there's a couple points that I wanted to make here with the deferred maintenance, given that was a specific request that came back came from the March meeting that we focused on at the board today. You'll see the top two priority rankings are the $15 million, what has historically been referred to as the HECSHEC appropriation, as well as an additional $85 million in deferred maintenance. Our institutions, as you all know, have a huge log of critical maintenance needs. You know, we're talking, I don't want to go into minutia, but, you know, because we're talking a lot of boilers, HVAC units, but these are things that we need across the state at all our institutions. Every institution, I believe, has HVAC and chiller projects. We've got critical roof replacements. We've got seismic retrofits, central plant upgrades. You know, there's boilers and chillers. There's exhaust systems. The list goes on and on and on. And so I wanted to provide at least some general understanding. You know, typically what happens, as everyone in this room knows, you can have a list of prioritized maintenance projects that you want to hit, but if you have an HVAC unit that goes out tomorrow, guess what? Your list changes. So we know that the institutions have the need to fully expend this funding, and we will work with them to prioritize what their projects look like with the understanding that sometimes emergent things just pop up. You'll also notice from the list itself, beyond the two top projects, on the ranking list itself, you'll see a number of individual deferred maintenance projects. You know, and some are very large, and number 10 here on the slide is an HVAC replacement, you know, for the main campus at UNR. That is a critical maintenance need, right? And so is the Fallon campus, Sage Building, HVAC, and roof repair. So we've got some general buckets of money, and we've got individual projects on this ranking list. And what that reflects is the dire need to address maintenance throughout the system. Really quick, I wanted to provide some high-level stats, because I know this was something that came up in the March meeting. I think, as this body all knows, traditionally we get the $15 million for deferred maintenance. That has been the case for many, many, many biennium, with one exception. In the 23 to 25 biennium, in addition to that $15 million, there was a $50 million investment for maintenance across the system of higher education. So what does that look like? Specifically focusing on the state's capital improvement program that funds construction, maintenance, and planning projects. If you look at the maintenance projects that are funded in the state's capital improvement program, in the current biennium, there was about $236 million in maintenance projects. Of that, $15 million went to the system of higher education. So that's about 6% of the maintenance. In 2023-25, as I said, the system got $65 million. The total CIP maintenance was about $259 million that biennium. That was about 25% of the maintenance overall approved by the state. So that biennium was a huge help for our institutions. And I think that there is a reasonable approach to asking for and justifying, you know, an increase beyond just the $15 million. And I can go back to prior biennium what those percentages look like. But they have ranged anywhere from that 6% to a high of 25%. Looking at the appropriation as an overall amount of what went to deferred maintenance through the CIP. I won't go through all of these projects in detail, because the institutions did present them at the March meeting. However, I did want to take an opportunity to talk about, beyond the deferred maintenance rankings 3, 4, and 5, again, I'm coming in late to the discussions, but I know that there is a lot of robust discussion around these particular projects, and so I just do want to take an opportunity to talk a little bit about a little more detail about these particular projects, and we'll likely have to defer to the institutions if you have specific projects. But the project for the College of Southern Nevada and the Northwest Campus Construction Project, this is really an investment into an expansion for the institution into the Northwest Valley. And this is would require some infrastructure investments in addition to construction of a first building on that campus. But I think as we look at this project and the board looks at this project, we look at it as beyond a one building project. This is a project that I think is being brought forward to get some of the initial investments into that area that are needed for the master plan of having a campus in the Northwest Valley. And so I do want to note that. I do want to note, too, for this project that there has been prior investments. About $9 million has been invested in this project to date. $4.2 million of that comes from the state, and I believe $4.8 million came from the college. And so that those prior investments, as I mentioned earlier, were part of the consideration. And so just wanted to make a couple comments on that project. As I mentioned, we did ensure, we want to make sure that the institution funds are reflected here. The Nevada State College, that's a planning project. As I mentioned, it was important for the business officers to include both a construction and planning project. As you all know, this is a project that's been a priority of the board in the past, and so that certainly was consideration for this project. And I don't mean to minimize anything for the projects that fall after these top ones, but I do want to also just hit on really quick the Fire Rescue Training Center and at TMCC. This is a phase two approach to efforts that have already been taken on by the college. And I believe that I had the number. I believe that there was several million dollars invested, and I apologize. I don't have the figure in front of me, but TMCC, I believe it invested $6 million in phase one of this project, and so this is phase two of that project. And again, I don't want to minimize, you know, any of the other projects, but I also recognize that you don't want me up here going through all 23 of them. So I will, the list is here. Again, you know, I think Chair Brooks, what the intent or charge in part today is, if the board, you know, would like to have any robust detailed discussion on these projects, you have that opportunity. If the board would like to direct staff and or the institutions to provide additional information, reorder projects to bring back to the May meeting, that's sort of the direction that would be helpful. So we've got 23 projects. Again, I'm not going to go through them in detail, but I will, if it's okay, Chair Brooks, there was a specific request, and thank you, Regent Del Carlo, for asking for conversation or some information about the HEC check, the $15 million. And so I'll try and quickly go through this to give a little bit of history to maybe pitch a request myself if we could stop using the term HEC, and I'll get to that. But wanted to make sure that the board understood sort of what this revenue source is and some history behind where the $15 million came from. So under Chapter 463 in Nevada Revised Statute, there's an annual $250 excise tax on every slot machine that's operated in the state. Of the revenue that's collected under this statute, there's statutory distribution requirements. The first $5 million collected goes into the Capital Construction Fund for Higher Education, the HEC fund. Any amount that's collected over the initial $5 million 20% of those collections go into the Special Capital Construction Fund for Higher Education. 80% goes to the State Education Fund for support of K-12 education. Those are the statutory outlines of the revenue and how it gets distributed. In 1983, so over 40 years ago, due to budgetary shortfalls, there was a legislative change made. And what that change did is it redirected that $5 million in the HEC fund to the state general fund. The discussion around the time was that that $5 million would go to the general fund to provide general fund support for higher education. Once it goes to the general fund, you can't track that. But the HEC distribution to the general fund has occurred ever since that statutory change. That annual $5 million is on the sheets as part of the Economic Forum's revenue projections. And so since 1983, the HEC funds have not been used to support capital projects with the system of higher education. As an agreement for that lost funding, the state committed to providing $10 million in general fund or bond funds to continue supporting maintenance projects every biennium. And that has been the policy ever since. And I say at least $10 million because the remaining $5 million comes from the Sheck Fund. And the Sheck Fund is not always flush enough to provide $5 million each biennium. And the reason being is that the slot tax that's collected and distributed to the Sheck Fund under the statute is allowed to be used to service debt for the universities. So the state and the system can issue bonds and back those bonds with debt service from the Sheck Fund. So what we have to look at every biennium in terms of funding this $15 million is how much slot tax revenue after meeting the debt service obligations is available to contribute towards the $15 million. And so that is something that the governor's finance office and our office and the legislative Council Bureau staff will work through as this project gets advanced through the CIP project process. So I would make a couple points here. Excuse me. One, the $15 million is not guaranteed every biennium, but it has been a policy of the legislature, and it has been funded at least $15 million every biennium. I don't think that there's would ever be any appetite to look at something less, but I also believe that the $15 million is insufficient. So what I would say is back to the slot tax revenue, just so everyone understands, is that annually that money that's going into the check, we're bringing in about, I think it was $7.6 million in the most recent fiscal year, and we've got about $6.5 million in annual debt. So there's not a lot left after servicing the debt to provide slot tax for deferred maintenance. The current debt, there's about $52 million left, and the debt schedule has that being retired in 2033. But the most important thing that we've got to always consider with this slot tax revenue is that we are ensuring coverage of the debt service on any bonds that have been issued. Now, the last time that bonds were issued under the authority of this chapter was in the 2013 session. It was through Assembly Bill 501 and provided some funding for the Thomas and Mack renovations at UNLV and some various projects up at the University of Nevada, Reno. So back to my request, I know that we have historically referred to this as the HEC-SHEC project. I believe the HEC reference is confusing and that it has not, given that it has not gone towards capital funding for the system in over 40 years. We can continue to refer to it as the Heck Check project, or we can look at something different. And I'm happy to bring a suggestion at the next meeting or leave it as it is. And with that, Chair Brooks, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Are there any questions from Regents? Regent Brown.
Thank you, Regent Brown, for the record. Okay, so I had written some notes and then your explanation answered some of those, but then brought a whole bunch of new questions on top of that. Just flat, like on the top. So if it's not guaranteed to get the $15 million, but also it's usually what happens. I just asked Google, and 1983 $15 million comes to about $49.7 million in today's money. I mean, obviously significantly more. Is there any appetite to actually, you know, adjust it for inflation and give us more bonding power and money?
Thank you, Regent Brown. For the record, Brody Leiser. I think there, in the 2023-25 biennium, where the legislature approved $65 million in total, that exactly to your point was recognized that the $15 million, while it is greatly appreciated, it does not go anywhere near, you know, as far as it went in 1983. And so I think, to your point, that is part of the request that's before you and on the priority list, is looking at that additional $80 million for deferred maintenance, is that we as a system, and I need to dive into this more, but I don't know the square footage figures, but my assumption or guess is that the square footage across the institutions of higher education is probably comparable to the state as a whole. Outside of higher ed. And the challenge, part of the challenge from my experience in the past, has been the argument or the stance when the Public Works Board has considered additional requests, is that the requests submitted for deferred maintenance outside of the $15 million when compared to maintenance requests for other state agencies, are just not prioritized as high. So how do we go to the Public Works Board in August to make the argument that, you know, our institutions need help with maintenance, just like other agencies of the state? And generally, there has been a policy recognition, at least through ongoing operations and maintenance costs, that it takes for the instructional buildings of our institutions, that the state funds those ongoing operational costs. And there's a correlation to deferred maintenance there, I believe, too. So it's going to be very important how we message this going forward. If the board chooses to prioritize maintenance beyond the $15 million, and that's a strategy that I'll be looking at and talking with the chancellor and talking with the institutions, because we have a great need across the systems, and so we need to message that the right way to the governor, to the Public Works Board first in August, then to the governor after that, and then work with the legislative body.
Thank you so much, Regent Brown, for the record. I want to first say, obviously, receiving $15 million towards some of this is obviously appreciated. It gets us across some line, and it gets us keep moving. I just can't help but wonder, like, you know,
we get a lot of criticism for always asking for things, but I mean, I will always go back to, we are the workforce pipeline for this state. We are the economic driver for the state. These buildings are housing every student that will make our state better in the future. And they're old, and we do what's we do what we can with all of them. And I also have to just look at like the math. If this was, you know, adjusting for inflation year over year for the last 43 years, you know, we would be in a very different place. We wouldn't be coming with $85 million. And so where I am so grateful, and I know that the state wants to prioritize education. It is also a larger rhetoric of our state of like, if we really are going to prioritize legislation or education, it has to show up in every facet. And this is one of those places to me where it's like, this was earmarked 43 years ago as something that they knew higher ed institutions needed. They knew the system needed it because we were doing what we could with the facilities that we have. So I actually would like to see us have this conversation and figure out how can we adjust it. We know, and I also want to just acknowledge, I know that, you know, we're going to go into a legislative session with a tough budget. Like, I'm not being Pollyanna about this. Like, I'm very clear that everybody is asking for everything, and we all want more to do more with it. But I also just think, you know, how crucial we are to the future of Nevada, that I think this is a really good starting spot to look and say the investment from the state that was promised 43 years ago has not kept up with what we are doing. So I just wanted to say that for the record. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. And Heather, Regent Brown and I are on the same track because I did the same Google. My Google came up with $15 million over 40 years ago. In today's dollars, is $44,472,000. So I would definitely vote, and I'm totally in favor of putting this in our strategy. I am very appreciative for the $50 million that we got in 23-25. But I agree. I mean, we are the workforce engines, and you have to look. We are competing against other state agencies, but we have 110,000 students that are depending on this, plus at least 15,000 faculty and staff. And I know we have a building in on the UNLV campus, their oldest building. It's like a heat wave whenever the heat start or the summer starts, and it started early down there. And this is so important to the health and well-being of our students, faculty, staff, and anybody that steps on our campus. So I agree. If they had kept up over the years, it would be great. I mean, we had to raise our tuition over those 40 plus years. It wasn't a fun thing for us to do, but we had to keep the doors open. And I really think this should be one of our highest priorities. It all boils down to the health and well-being and the safety of our campuses. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward, Brody, and I'm so glad you're on board and you have so much history and knowledge, and you have relationships, and that's really, really important for us as a board. It's so important, these relationships, and you can understand seeing this with your own eyes, and I hope some of the campuses will reach out to you and show you some of their worst projects, because you're going to be the person on the front line making these requests. So this has to be one of our really top asks, and additional money, because it just is going to grow. We're building new buildings. I mean, since I've been a regent, we've had at least 6, 7, 8 new buildings, but everything else is aging. And at some point, those new buildings get old too, and they're going to need things. I mean, unfortunately, that's how it works. So just thank you, Brody, for bringing this forward and having this robust discussion today. I appreciate it.
Regent Gokachia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regent Gokachia for the record. And I guess I'm going to look to Mr. Leiser there. You know, I'm very concerned. All right, we're going to move away from HAC in the SEC, and which is a set amount of funding. But I don't think we want to jump in the pool with the whole state package and the deferred CIP maintenance, because if we get in line with those guys, you know, you've got DOC, you've got DMV, all the state institutions, you know, so I think we're better off and again, I'm turning looking to Mr. Leiser, you know, we've got a carved out piece. Let's expand that piece. That 15 IE goes to 50 or as an earmark in the budget. I'm just concerned about if we just, Nishi just jumps in the pool with them. All the rest of the state agencies in deferred maintenance, because, well, Brody, you probably got that number right on the top of your head, but it's billions in deferred maintenance.
Thank you, Regent Goycochea, for the record, Brody Leiser. To respond to your comments, I know that, like I mentioned, there was well over $200 million of maintenance projects in the CIP, and you're absolutely right. The Department of Corrections chews up quite a bit of that with the aging in facilities that they have. I guess there's an approach, and we can talk about it, of do you, from the capital improvement process, does the board want to look at separating the traditional $15 million request and have a, you know, a $15 million request and an $85 million request? Or is the desire to combine those into a single request? And then beyond that, Regent Goycochea, one thing I do want to comment on with regards to the competition in the CIP across the state, you know, I don't know at this point what the budget's going to look like in terms of the Economic Forum's projections or what the revenues collected to date have been. I will tell you that over the past couple biennium, as you are aware, there has been a tremendous amount of one-time funding available due to the ending fund balance in the general fund, and deferred maintenance is a great candidate to use that funding. So we are talking about an approach that we are going to hit this. You all as a board will determine the priorities, but we are looking at including it here in the CIP at a total of $100 million and understanding the competition that goes on with other state agencies in the capital improvement program. And the past couple biennium, the amount of the ending general fund balance, that we're looking at also putting this in under items for special consideration as a straight, like a one-shot appropriation. And so I think we need to look at, to your point, do we have other avenues outside of the CIP that comes through Public Works to look at deferred maintenance funding? And when we've got institutions that have the expertise of project management and facilities management, those institutions can, a lot of the institutions can manage those projects. Smaller institutions may need help, but I think we can look at one-shot appropriations. That would be a bigger discussion because there are certainly considerations of trying to have all of the state's capital projects in one area, but we're looking at other options. I hope that addresses your question.
Yes, if I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that's where I'm headed, and I'm thinking, as we look at this as a board, we probably want to come up with a number someplace, whether it's 50 or 100 million or whatever, that will be at least a replacement for the 15 million in the HEC fund. But we, you know, a standard that's there for, you know, it's going to be there to use. And so we can at least accomplish some of this stuff. Otherwise, I'm concerned if we just jump in the pool with, you know, all the deferred maintenance statewide. Yeah, I know. The rainy day fund is doing good. There is money in the budget, but you know, we're just one cycle away from going back to where we were in 10, or you know, you name the year. It's not solid or positive. So I guess as a board, I'm thinking, and just thinking out loud as much as anything, there, you know, are we better off to, you know, lock in a set amount for maintenance, and then yeah. The other deferred maintenance above that, go ahead and jump in the pool with the rest of the state. But knowing full well, the best you're going to get is, you pick the number, Brody, 20%, 30%, if you're lucky, you know, because there is a lot of competition with other state agencies.
Regent Coicachee, I mean, you're absolutely right, right? That the challenges that our institutions are having with their facilities, everyone else in state government is having those challenges because of a lack of investment in deferred maintenance, whether that's because of the recessions or limited funding resources. But, yeah, this is a problem across the state.
So I guess one more thing then. What number gets us, catches our deferred maintenance up over a 20-year lifetime? You know, what number? Is it 100 million? Is it 150 million? That has to be an appropriation that we can say in 10 years, all of a sudden, we can catch up with where we are. And I think that's what we need to look at as a board and say, okay, look, in 10 years, this is how much money it's going to take for us to get even with the board and across the board. And we have to go to the legislature and say, well, this is what it's going to take. And right now, it's a good time. Then one more question, Brody. And again, we're waiting to see what the Economic Forum says, the new November date. But bottom line, we do have that Economic Forum in May, which sometimes is an indicator. Would you agree?
I'm sorry, Regent Goycochea. The other Economic Forum meetings throughout the schedule, they typically do provide a projection of where the revenue is to date. That is correct. If you were talking about the May date during the legislative session, but I know that the forum, when they met in December, they did some preliminary projections on fiscal year to date. Generally, at that point, it's so early on in the fiscal year, it's hard to see where we're at. But generally, the FY26 revenues were on track to meet the projections. There's a little bit of an anomaly with the commerce tax because some of that funding that should have been booked in FY25 got booked in 26. So we really need to get closer to the end of the fiscal year to see where they're at. But they do usually have agenda items to talk about where we're at fiscal year to date. It's just that November meeting that they have to actually do a projection for the upcoming biennium.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll go back to Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Brooks. I just want to say if ever there was a time where the state could benefit from having a lottery and have those funds go to all the state's maintenance, I can't think of a better time. It gets shut down every year at the legislature. It's really too bad because this is something that could really help our state. If we had a lottery dedicated to the maintenance of every state building, and then whatever's left over, if there is anything left over, then into education. So I'm just going to put that out on the record. Who knows who's listening? Maybe somebody will write a bill for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from Regents? There was a question I'd like to ask CFO Leiser, but it was on the it had to do with the fee waivers, and it was the $27 million in terms of fee waivers. Was that part of the $1.9 billion budget, or was that other assessed monies outside of the $1.9 billion budget?
Thank you, Chair Brooks. The fee waiver requests, I think it's about $23 million for the upcoming biennium. We'll have to do some calculations. I don't know if that will fit within the $1.9 million agency cap. I believe that's the question that you're asking, or if that would need to be presented or classified as an item for special consideration. We've got a little bit of work to do to understand how much room there is beyond the base budget between that and the cap as to what can fit within the cap. So I will have to bring that details back to either the May or June meeting to say, okay, now that we've got a good idea of what our base looks like, what the delta is between that and the cap, and generally there's not a whole lot of room. And so my anticipation would be that enhancement priorities will likely fall outside of the cap. But we still request them. Yeah, it's just a matter of the classification.
Okay, thank you. And then I know that we're coming back again later next month to have conversations and solidify the priorities in it. Certainly there were voices. Regis did bring up some great points about directions that we can go in and other considerations. And I thought perhaps even if it extends that agenda a little bit longer, because we have to solidify things before June, that maybe there's some additional information that can come before the board during the next meeting. And if there were regents that wanted to do more of a deep dive, that they would be best to give you a call and have that type of discussion so that things can be brought back to the board. Vice Chair Goodman.
Thank you. And I do think it might be a priority to make sure that the full board is aware of just what's happening with that Northwest campus with CSN, just so, you know, that looks like a huge number, but, you know, what kind of the plan is moving forward. I think it would benefit the board for everybody to know what our plan is with that $135 million ask. So,
thank you. In addition to the other items, obviously. And I do believe that would wrap this up. Thank you very much. We appreciate all the information that you provided us, CFO Leiser. And I think at this point, we'll just take maybe a 5-minute administrative break before we move on to the next agenda item. Thank you.
Thank you.